Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Parthian Vengeance by Peter Darman, narrated by Michael Page. Chapter 1. It had been 3 years now, many months spent preparing for an attack I was sure would come. While the trade caravans travelled east and west along the Silk Road, transporting the precious material, ivory and spices from China through the Parthian Empire to fulfil the insatiable demand of Egypt and Rome, my army prepared. Every day the mud-brick forts that had been built north and south of Dura kept watch for an army that might attempt to approach the city by surprise. Every day I received the same reports. There was no sign of any hostile forces. It had been over 3 years since the death of Phraates, the King of Kings, who had supposedly died of a broken heart, brought on by my having stormed the city of Uruk. This city was the capital of the kingdom of Mycenae, and the residence of King Chosroes, the man who had marched an army to Dura and had attempted to storm it. But his army had been destroyed in front of my city, and then I had captured Uruk, and Phraates had supposedly taken his own life. The empire was now ruled by his son Mithridates, the man I had long suspected of being responsible for the death of his father. And ever since I had waited and prepared for the day when Mithridates would send an army against me. The days, weeks, and months passed, and nothing happened.
"Not this again!" barked my opponent.
Lucius Domitus came at me again with a thrust of his sword over the top of his shield, aiming the blow at my own shield. Normally he would attempt to thrust his short sword, a straight double-bladed weapon, into my neck or face, but as we were only practicing and I was his friend, he put aside the pleasure of killing me. Domitus, like many Romans, was shorter than me by around 6 inches. Muscular, crop-haired, and uncompromising, he had been by my side since we had fought together under Spartacus in Italy all those years ago. He stabbed my oval shield, modelled on the Roman scutum, again with the point of his sword, forcing me back once more.
"It's a good job we're doing this for sport, otherwise I would have killed you twice by now."
I rested my shield on the ground. "You're right. My mind's elsewhere today. My apologies."
"Daydreaming about Mithridates again?"
I smiled.
"How did you guess?"
He sheathed his sword.
"It's written all over your face. Come on, you're no use to man or beast today."
He began walking back to the camp, a sprawling collection of tents enclosed within a mud-brick wall half a mile from Dura. My city was located on the west bank of the mighty river Euphrates, and the dues raised from the caravans crossing the river were not Dura's only source of revenue, but they were crucial to the kingdom's prosperity. When the animosity between myself and King of Kings, so-called Mithridates, had escalated into open warfare, he had decreed that no trade caravans were to travel through the kingdom of Dura Europos. I had at first been greatly alarmed at this, but the royal order had been ignored by the merchants and had earned Mithridates the wrath of China's emperor and Egypt's pharaoh. No wonder. The route through my kingdom saved merchants around a month's journey time. Time was money, and money was too important to be compromised by the arguments of kings. After the humiliation of Chosroes' defeat and his father's death, I had expected Mithridates to march against me, but nothing had happened. Now, with the beginning of a new year, I again began to wonder if the King of Kings would send an army against Dura.
"You waste your time dwelling on what will never happen," said Domitus, handing me a cup of water as I sat in his command tent in the middle of the camp. "He must come sometime. This kingdom's existence stands as a physical affront to his authority."
Domitus shrugged and sat in one of those chairs opposite me.
"A man, and I use the term loosely when referring to Mithridates, thinks twice before going up against someone who has won as many victories as you have. In any case, he prefers to let others do his fighting for him."
I emptied the cup and then toyed with it, turning it round as I held it in my hand. What Domitus said was true enough.
Mithridates had achieved the high crown probably through murder, but every day that I ruled at Dura was a personal insult to him, and I knew that he would like nothing more than to see me dead and my kingdom destroyed. I placed the cup back on the small table beside me and stood up. Perhaps you are right, but when he does come, I will be ready. Same time next week, Domitus? Same time, same place. But don't bother turning up unless you are in the right frame of mind. It's no fun if you don't put up a fight. I raised my arm in acknowledgement and left his tent. I am Parthian, and that will never change, but my time in Italy, first as a slave and then fighting in an army of slaves under Spartacus, had given me the opportunity to see at first hand the military methods of the Romans. They had left a lasting impression upon me. Parthians were famed for their great armies of horsemen, but these armies lacked discipline. Most kings in the empire had small retinues of professional soldiers, mainly mounted personal followers and palace guards. In times of war, they would call upon the lords of their kingdoms to furnish them with thousands more troops, tens of thousands in some cases. But these soldiers followed their vassal lords, fighting around them in battle and doing their bidding. And when the fighting stopped, they went with their lord back to the farms they worked on his lands. In Italy, Spartacus had trained and organized his army along Roman lines, with the exception of his mounted arm, which I had commanded. We had beaten the Romans on many occasions, but I had seen how effective Roman discipline and organization had been, and was determined to combine them with Parthian tactics. When King of Kings Sinitruses had given me my own kingdom, may Shamash bless his memory, I had the opportunity to put my ideas into practice. The result was the camp I was now strolling through, a giant rectangle that housed tents arranged in neat rows and blocks, workshops, stables, hospital granaries, and a parade ground. The oiled leather home of Domitus, the large and well-appointed headquarters tent, stood in the center of the camp. Either side of it were two smaller tents containing the legionary standards. Guards ringed these three tents. As I made my way to the camp stables, I encountered one of the companions. Gruff, burly, and the veteran of many battles, Tumelicus was a German who had fought beside my friend Castus, a fellow German, now long dead, in Italy. "How are your skills with the short sword progressing, Pacorus?" I may have been a king, but all the companions were allowed such familiarity. Discipline in Dora's army was strict for all, but there were no ranks between those who had served under Spartacus. "I think I might be getting the edge over Domitus," I lied. He raised an eyebrow at me. "Really?" I shook my head. "No, not really." He looked round at a century of legionaries marching past us in its ranks, a centurion at its head barking orders at his charges. He raised his vine cane at Tumelicus in salute, for my German friend was the first spear centurion in the Doran Legion. This status was usually accorded to the bravest, meanest, and most ruthless man in the Legion. Tumelicus met all these criteria. "Perhaps I should ask you to take my place, and then we can determine who is the best swordsman in the army," I said. He looked at me with his pale blue eyes. "We all know that Lucius Domitus is the best soldier in the army." I smiled at him. He was probably right, but it was a close call. "Well, I best get back to the city. Children to attend to. How are your daughters?" "Loud, full of energy, and running rings round me." I was now the father of three children, all girls. Claudia, the eldest, now 5, Isabella, 2, and the youngest, Esther, just 6 months old. "I know how you feel. I have 2 of my own, both boys, and both are bundles of energy. They live in the city with their mother, future soldiers for your army. Hopefully, Tumelicus, they won't see as much fighting as we have." He looked appalled at the notion. "I hope they do. I'm raising them to be soldiers. No point in having the skills to use a sword and having no opportunity to show them off." "Well, let us hope that they won't have to do any fighting for the next few years, at least." He smiled wryly. "Have it your own way." He saluted and paced away to attend to his duties as I continued my journey to the stables. Once there, I saddled my horse, a white stallion with muscular shoulders, thick neck, and blue eyes, called Remus. He was usually quartered in the stables in the citadel, the city's stronghold perched atop a rocky escarpment overlooking the river Euphrates. The citadel also housed the palace, the royal armories, the treasury, Domitus' headquarters building, which he rarely slept in, barracks, stables, granary, and various other workshops. Like all the horses of Dura's army, he lived a regal existence on the most nutritious fodder available, and received the best care and attention from a host of farriers and veterinaries. When I visited the legionary camp, he was fussed over by the grooms who worked in its stables, but just as when I had first owned him, I always liked to saddle him myself. Like all our mounts, his saddle had been made especially for him. The hardwood frame was contoured to the shape of his back. It had four horns, two at the front and two at the back, to hold the rider in place. The front two horns were made so that they swept back to wrap themselves around the thighs of the rider and thereby anchor him in place. The rear horns were vertical, but the joining arch between them was sloped to offer a curved feel to the rear of the saddle that also created a dip to form the seat. The entire frame was covered with felt for padding. Over the top of this were stitched pieces of rawhide leather. The leather was stained and finished with a polish containing a beeswax base to seal the material. Under his saddle, Remus wore a white saddle cloth edged with red. Such equipment did not come cheaply, and neither did Remus' bridle, head collar, reins, and the rest of his saddlery. I had just finished tightening his straps when a mounted courier halted his horse in front of me and raised his hand in salute. "Hail, Majesty! Your presence is needed at the palace urgently." I was suddenly alarmed. "Who has made this request?" "Your sorceress, Majesty." I had feared that one of my children had been taken ill, but if it had been so, the Queen would have summoned me. As I heaved myself into the saddle, I felt more curious than apprehensive. I galloped from the camp and made my way to the city. The courier followed me as we galloped east along the road that led to Dura's main entrance, the Palmyrene Gate. Over the gate was a great stone arch, on top of which was a large stone statue of a griffin, Dura's symbol and protector. The city had 24 other towers along its circuit wall, and from each one flew my banner of a red griffin on a white background. I slowed Remus as we entered the city. The guards at the gates and on the walls snapped to attention as I passed them. As usual, the city streets were thronged with tradesmen, citizens, and beasts of burden, and it took us a while to thread our way through the multitude to reach the citadel. Dura's citadel could never be described as a beautiful or ornate place, with its thick walls, solid squat buildings, and its barracks, stables, and armories, but it was strong, built to withstand and defeat assaults and sieges. Perched high on the rocky escarpment on which the whole city was built, it radiated strength. I dismounted and handed Remus' reins to a stable hand, then walked up the stone steps that fronted the palace. The courier bowed and left me as I walked through the entrance hall and into the throne room. At the far end, sitting on my throne, which in truth was nothing more than a simple high-backed wooden chair, was Dobai. She had been the one who had foretold all those years ago at the court of King of Kings Sinatruces of my going to Italy and my return with Gallia, my wife. Dobai had made my city her home, and her gift of foresight and closeness to the gods had made her feared and respected throughout the kingdom. Now she was sitting on my throne as she regarded me with her black eyes. Queen Gallia was sitting next to her. "May I know the reason you sent a courier to fetch me like an errant schoolboy?" I inquired. "Do not be churlish, son of Hatra," replied Dobai. "It does not suit you. Then I will ask again, why did you send for me?"
"Your life is in danger, Pacorus," said Gallia. My eyes went from Dobai to my wife, from ugliness and old age to beauty and youth. How contrasting they were! Dobai, old and foul, her black hair lank, while Gallia's long blonde hair and beautiful face with its high cheekbones and slim nose were perfection.
"It is true, son of Hatra,"
continued Dobai. I was taking my afternoon sleep when a vision appeared to me of a griffin limping and afraid, a blade in its belly and blood gushing from the wound. Every time I fight on the battlefield, I am in danger. Dobai scowled. I did not mean that. I sense an assassin's dagger in your belly. I must confess a chill ran down my spine. The prophecies of Dobai were not to be dismissed out of hand. You must have a personal bodyguard, said Gallia, looking alarmed. Soldiers who will be with you at all times. At all times? The idea filled me with horror. I have guards enough. They fill the citadel and the city. There are also thousands of soldiers camped half a mile away. I do not intend to spend my life looking over my shoulder. I smiled. Besides, the servants in the citadel have been with us for years. I trust them. With your life? Asked Dobai. They have not poisoned my food or stuck a knife in my guts yet. Why should they do so now? My words were met with stern countenances. Gallia started shaking her head. The risk is too great. We will have more guards in the palace, she pointed at me, and you will not be riding alone in the foreseeable future. I shall organize an escort for you. Dobai nodded approvingly at her. It is well that you take my words seriously, child. I did not say that I did not believe you, I reproached her, merely that I will not live my life in fear. Perhaps the Amazons should protect you, mused Gallia. At least I know I can trust them. In Italy she had recruited a group of females that had served in my cavalry and named them Amazons. Now a queen of the Parthian Empire, Gallia retained her Amazons as a bodyguard. There were always 100 of them, but the idea that I would be protected by a group of females was ridiculous. It would lead to derision. I will not require the services of the Amazons, I said curtly, then looked at Dobai. Was it revealed to you when an attempt would be made on my life? What he or she will look like? Dobai glowered at me. If I knew that, then I could send someone to kill the assassin myself. Well, I said, let us keep this matter among ourselves. There is no need to burden others with something that may not occur. It will occur unless we are vigilant, insisted Gallia. Your queen speaks the truth, son of Hatra. Nevertheless, I replied, we will keep this our little secret. The matter is closed. I may have seemed untroubled by Dobai's revelation, but for the rest of that day and the day after, I was uneasy. I began to see danger everywhere and became a bag of nerves because of it. Gallia increased the number of guards both inside and outside the palace and had them stationed behind and beside the dais in the throne room when I received foreign embassies or heard the petitions of Dura's citizens. Dobai took to attending all these gatherings, and after a while I looked to her first to see her reaction when a visitor was presented to me. With each one I expected her to nod alarmingly to indicate that the assassin stood before me, but after examining each individual carefully she just shrugged and shook her head. After a month of this I grew tired and stood down the extra guards. Things returned to normal. Perhaps not all Dobai's dreams came true after all. Shortly afterwards, at the weekly council meeting held in the headquarters building in the citadel, the official home of Domitus, he brought up the subject of the additional guards. In attendance, as usual, were Godars, the city governor, Rassan, the royal treasurer, and Prince Orodes, a dear friend, now an exile from his homeland. Gallia also liked to sit in on these meetings, but today she and Dobai had taken Claudia on a visit to the tiny harbour positioned at the foot of the escarpment directly under the citadel. They had promised to take her fishing on the river, and as the day was clear and the waters calm, they had left early in the morning, promising to return with a basket full of fish for our evening meal.
So, said Domitus, would you care to enlighten us about why the citadel was suddenly filled with additional guards? I had hoped to keep the matter discreet. Domitus laughed. No chance of that with your palace walls lined with soldiers. Well, if you must know, Dobai had a vision and told me that I would be the target of an assassin's dagger.
Rassan, who had taken to bringing a clerk with him to these meetings, a tall, pale youth with light brown hair, immediately instructed the boy not to make a note of that. My treasurer was an able, conscientious man, but was prone to take alarm at the slightest provocation. It was so now.
"Assassin, Majesty? That is grave news indeed."
I raised my hand at him. "I'm sure it is nothing. In any case, I do not intend to go skulking round in my own kingdom." Domitus was frowning.
"You should have told me."
"And what would you have done?" I asked.
"Tighten security."
"Which means more guards." I shook my head. "No, that would not do at all. There are thousands of people who travel through Dura every year. They cannot all be stopped and searched. That would interfere with trade, and soon the caravans would start to avoid us, and we can't have that. Is that not correct, Rassan?" Rassan began shaking his head vigorously.
"Yes, Majesty, it is most important that trade is not interfered with."
He looked at his clerk.
"Make a note of that."
Rassan regarded anything that threatened the kingdom's profits with abject horror. "So that's an end to the matter," I said. "On another subject, I have been thinking for a while of establishing in the kingdom a breeding center for horses."
"Sensible idea," remarked Godars. "At the moment, we have to hire studs from your father's kingdom or further afield, such as Media and Atropaini."
"Exactly," I said. "It makes more sense if we can establish our own herds to supply the army. Cheaper as well." I could see Rassan nodding approvingly. "Of course," I continued, "it will be expensive to start with." Rassan stopped nodding.
"Expensive, Majesty?"
"Naturally, I'm only interested in the finest bloodstock, and I would prefer if we could have a herd of pure whites, such as the horses of my father's bodyguard." Godars, the governor of Dura and the city's father figure, exhaled loudly.
"That will take a lot of time and a lot of money. Creating such a herd will not be easy, Pacorus."
Godars leant back in his chair and ran his hands over his scalp in contemplation.
"It could take many years. Purchasing suitable studs will be very expensive, and even when you have them, there is no guarantee they will produce pure whites."
"Nevertheless," I said, "I want you to make a start, Godars. Contact the breeders in Hatra, Media, and Atropaini."
"And the funds will be made available?"
"Pay whatever it costs." Rassan went ashen-faced.
"I really must protest, Majesty."
"There's a surprise," muttered Domitus.
"After all," said Rassan, ignoring Domitus, "surely one horse is much the same as another?"
I, Godars, and Arodes looked at him with horror. What he had said equated to sacrilege.
"I can assure you, Lord Rassan," said Arodes slowly and purposely, "there is a great difference between horse breeds."
Arodes was a prince of Susiana, a kingdom in the center of the empire. He was a brave and loyal friend to me, and that loyalty had cost him his crown for supporting me.
"What Prince Arodes says is true, my old friend," added Godars. "The finest breeds of Parthian horses are the Przewalski, Karaber, Achalteke, and Nisian. Remus is descended from Carthaginian stock, of course. You wish to breed from him as well?" he asked me.
"I would like him to sire a line, yes." Rassan wore a blank look, and I could tell that we might as well have been talking in a foreign tongue, but I was excited by the idea, and so was Godars.
"Well," he said, "I will get started straight away."
Rassan cleared his throat, which was usually the signal that he had something to say, but was hesitant to speak his mind.
"Spit it out, Rassan." "Well, the thing is, Majesty, with the beginning of a new year, there arises the matter of the annual tribute to Ctesiphon."
"No tribute will be paid to Ctesiphon," I replied. "I will draw up a letter to that effect, inviting King Mithridates to come and take what is owed to him, should he so wish." Every year I always hoped that when Ctesiphon was notified of my refusal to pay any tribute, Mithridates would take umbrage and send an army against Dura. But he never had, much to my disappointment. I would welcome the chance to defeat him and his Lord High General, King Narses, the man who had once rebelled against King of Kings Phraates. I had defeated Narses in battle, but Narses and Mithridates had forged an alliance, and whereas I had bested them both on the battlefield, they had triumphed over me when it came to intrigue. Thus it was that the kingdom of Dura and its king were now outcasts from the Parthian Empire, and Mithridates was Parthia's high king. I had once been the empire's Lord High General, but now I was viewed with contempt by those who held the highest positions within the empire. It never ceased to rile me.
"There is no point in sulking, Pacorus. Nothing will happen, despite your desire that it be otherwise," said Godars.
Rassan looked decidedly uncomfortable, and Domitus laughed. Orodes appeared stern.
"You know he won't take the bait," said Domitus. "I don't know why you bother."
"To annoy Mithridates, of course, and to goad him into action."
"My stepbrother is full of malice, Pacorus," said Orodes. "He will send Narses only when his enemies are weakened."
"Dura will never be weak,"
I growled, earning a murmur of approval from Domitus.
"Enough talk of that traitorous little bastard, Mithridates," said Domitus. "Let's talk about Godars's wedding."
"What?" I was most surprised. I looked at my governor, who was blushing. Orodes was smiling at him, and Domitus gave him a hearty slap on the shoulders. Because of his age, I had assumed that Godars was happy being a single man, but it appeared that I was wrong. Rassan instructed the clerk to stop writing. Godars held up his hands.
"Domitus is exaggerating, I can assure you." "No, I ain't. Beard told me all about her. I had to work on him to get any information out of him, mind. We all know how tight-lipped he can be."
Beard was a Cappadocian and my head scout. We had known each other for over 13 years.
"So, Godars," I said, "are you going to enlighten us further on your romantic adventures?"
"Certainly not,"
he answered, and with that he folded his arms and said nothing further. The meeting over, afterwards I managed to winkle a few details out of Godars as I walked with him back to the governor's mansion just beyond the citadel's walls. Apparently he had become acquainted with a woman who was the daughter of the head of one of the richest transport guilds in Anawan, a kingdom on the eastern edge of the empire. She and her father had arrived in Dura a few weeks ago and had presented themselves at the governor's mansion. Her father had rented a well-appointed house in the city, and they had invited Godars to dine with them on several occasions. I thought it odd that a transport guild from the eastern frontier of the empire should want to establish a presence in Dura, but Godars told me that the woman's father was expanding the length of the route along the Silk Road that his guild controlled. This woman's father must have been very wealthy indeed to organize caravans that operated between Anawan and Dura and beyond, a distance of over 1,000 miles. Godars informed me with pride that her father's caravans could number up to 1,000 camels and horses. Each one had its own guards, and they carried not only silk, but also ceramics, bronze, spices, and medicines. It was a most impressive summary. By the time he had relayed all this information, we had reached the gates of his mansion.
"I would like to meet this mysterious woman of yours," I remarked casually. "And I would like you to meet her, Pacorus."
We strolled across the courtyard, flanked by stables, storerooms, a small barracks, and an armory that held the weapons of the governor's guards.
"Perhaps you could bring her to the palace one evening."
He paused at the foot of the mansion steps leading to the columned entrance.
"I have a better idea. Why don't you bring Gallia here, and I can entertain you both?"
I smiled at him.
"That would be most excellent, my friend."
Godars smiled. He was clearly very happy, and I was happy for him. He was extremely diligent in the execution of his duties as governor, and his workload had increased substantially after Dura had become a major trading hub in the western part of the empire. At that moment a figure appeared at the top of the steps, a man I estimated to be in his mid-20s with dark brown shoulder-length hair and a powerful build. He walked down the stone steps and bowed his head to Godars.
Ah, Pacorus, this is Polemo, my new headman. Polemo, meet your king.
Polemo placed his right hand on his chest and bowed his...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?